Ladies and gentlemen, The New Frontier, starring Edward G. Robinson. Ten years ago, in London, a group of men held a meeting. They faced, and still face, the most formidable task ever assigned to any group: the creation of conditions necessary for peaceful and friendly relations among nations. Their brief is contained in these words from Article 55 of the United Nations Charter.
The United Nations shall promote higher standards of living and conditions of economic and social progress and development.
The group charged with this great responsibility is the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, which held its 10th anniversary meeting recently in Geneva. In recognition of its work during the past decade, United Nations Radio presents The New Frontier.
Any young man today who wants to be an explorer may well become discouraged. He may well conclude, as he looks over a world map, that there's nothing left to explore. Since the days of Diaz and Columbus, at least, the surface of the seven seas has been charted. As for the land, well, with Everest conquered and the polar regions dotted with base camps and helicopters, only a few pockets of jungle remain for adventure. Of course, there's always outer space, looming ahead in a mist of gruesome romance and scientific speculation. Unfortunately, our rockets are still in the fireworks stage, so the young adventurer must wait, perhaps quite a while. Is there then really nothing left? The answer seems to be that while opportunities for extending the geographic frontiers of civilization are now somewhat limited, these have never been the only concern of the explorer. All inquiry is exploration. Every attempt to face and overcome the obstacles to human happiness and well-being is an expedition into difficult and unfamiliar territory. In this sense, in these dynamic years of the 20th century, we're all explorers. Today we all face the new frontier. And now, to unfold the role of the Economic and Social Council in this grand expedition, may I introduce your narrator, Mr. Edward G. Robinson.
We'd like to begin with a story, a true story, a story to illustrate the nature of this new frontier. It happened in Brazil. Not in the thriving industrial centers of São Paulo or Rio, but deep in the valley of the Amazon and the dense jungle of the state of Mato Grosso. The story is told in the words of the man who saw it happen.
In these jungles of the Mato Grosso live nearly 80 Indian tribes. I was there, living with the Indians, studying them as an anthropologist. The government of Brazil had asked me to go so that my findings might help them to understand the Indian, since he must inevitably take his place in the life of modern Brazil. The government is doing everything it can to make sure that the process of integration shall be as painless as possible. Now, to get to this region, you must fly. There are no roads, no airfields, so the plane must have floats to land on the waters of the Amazon itself. The result of this is that while the Indian might shrink in terror from the sight of a car, he is quite familiar with a plane. And not so long ago, the chief of one of the tribes was asked if he would like to take a flight. He would be taken, he was told, to see the great city of São Paulo, and then he would return to his village in the jungle. The chief accepted the offer with delight and enthusiasm. He saw São Paulo, the tall new buildings, the booming factories, the railways, the cars, the crowds of people, and his delight and enthusiasm left him. He returned to his village, and I heard him tell to his people,
"We are doomed. We cannot withstand the white man. For he is many, and we are few. He is mighty, and we are weak. I have seen things which tell me there is no hope for us. We are doomed.
The visit to the new world of San Paolo ended in tragedy. Arranged in all good faith and friendship, it destroyed the chief's confidence in himself, his people, and in their way of life. His self-respect crumbled. He sickened, grew weak, and died. He died of what we sometimes call a broken heart.
A true story. It was part of the Brazilian experience of an anthropologist, Alfred Matrow, when he was in the country on a mission for UNESCO. We've told it here, not because this program is about the Brazilian Indians, but because it has meaning for the whole world today. Every one of us, irrespective of nationality and degree of technical achievement, is today more or less in the position of the Indian chief. We're all facing dramatic new frontiers. We must avoid his fate. We must seek integration into the changing world. It is possible to check off any number of incidental differences between yesterday and today, the new techniques and this and that, new materials for this and that, the new shapes, sizes, and shadows of things to come. But where's the perspective? What is really happening?
The United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, recently put it this way. Two of the major revolutionary developments of our time are aimed, on the one side, at realizing the principle of self-determination, and on the other hand, at improving the economic and social conditions of life of that vast majority of mankind which, so far, has not shared in the advantages of modern technology. Whatever may be our political philosophy, we all recognize that it's impossible within any nation today to defend for long an inequality of economic conditions which the majority of the people believe to be unjust. What's a cause of unrest within a nation may become just as much a cause of unrest and instability in the international community. The problem has to be tackled.
Self-determination and the elimination of material injustice. To the first, we can give only a moment's attention, for the deep-rooted national conscience of people, long subject to foreign rule, has found and will continue to find its expression largely in political action. We are concerned with the second, with the efforts to bridge the gap between what have come to be known as the developed and the underdeveloped regions of the world. This is the province of the Economic and Social Council. What is the Council? Well, if you're by nature a critic of committees, if you're allergic to councils, you'll no doubt have a ready answer.
A council is desirous of facilitating.
A council notes with satisfaction. Or grave concern.
A council may recognize and commend.
It may also, on occasions, condemn.
And don't forget, a council always urges, requests, and invites.
Yes, the tedious jargon of the conference table. And like any council or committee, ECOSOC, as it's called for short, is not free of it. But behind the notings and the urgings, the requests and commendations within the stream of resolutions and reports that flows from its meetings, lies the very essence of peace. The Council's work represents, without doubt, one of the major hopes the world has for a future free from violence, inequality, and inhumanity. It is the one body which...
Just a minute. Let's not get carried away.
No. I'm not being carried away.
You're making rather extravagant claims. Can you justify them?
I believe so.
You're sure you're not just selling your own enthusiasm, a pet project?
Well, gentlemen, since you seem to regard me as a sort of common huckster, allow me to step down for a moment and hand over to someone who really knows ECOSOC. An expert will bear me out.
Well, the proof of the pudding, as they say, is in the eating. You propose, I imagine, to look at what the Council has done since its first meeting.
A little later, yes.
Good. Then I shall confine myself to the reason for our existence. I might say the inevitability of it, and to the manner in which we are organized. You see, when the UN was established in 1945, we had the experience of two world wars and 20 years of frustration and disillusionment to work on. When the nations gathered at San Francisco to write the UN Charter, we knew that peace could not rest on political foundations alone. True, the League of Nations had worked on the root causes of war in the social and economic fields. But with the new world organization, this aspect of international action was, from the very beginning, broadened in scope. The methods, the approach, the whole spirit of internationalism underwent far-reaching changes. The various organs and agencies of the United Nations were designed to be far more operational than anything known before. So it was natural and inevitable that there should be a focal point, a body that would not only promote human welfare itself, but coordinate the activities of all the international agencies working towards that end. Under Article 60 of the Charter, this tremendous responsibility was vested in the Economic and Social Council.
Now, with that as the background, what about the organization, the structure of the Council?
It is complicated, and I don't want to bother you with too much detail. Just the same, an outline might be helpful, if only to indicate the extraordinary range of the Council's interests. First, it consists of 18 members, elected by the General Assembly of the United Nations. At its meetings, you will also find representatives of the various specialized agencies, the World Health Organization, the Food and Agricultural Organization, and so on. It's through the Council that these agencies are related to the UN, and their annual reports go to the Council. This is important because it's the agencies who do a lot of the field work, and as I said just now, it is the job of ECOSOC to coordinate the work. You'll also find representatives of certain non-governmental organizations from time to time when their particular interests and experience can be of help. Then there are the regional economic commissions for Europe, Asia, and the Far East, and Latin America, which the Council set up to tackle economic problems on the spot. And there are the various functional commissions and committees on human rights, statistics, narcotic drugs, population, the status of women, to mention just some. So, you see, ECOSOC touches almost every phase of economic and social life in the world today, and its work is leaving its mark on the history of our time.
There, then, is the pudding, large and rich, compounded from the most complex of all recipes. To seek the proof of it, we must move about in both time and direction. ECOSOC held its 10th anniversary meeting at Geneva in July 1956 in the Palace of Nations by the lake. Its agenda looked both back and ahead. We'll try to do the same. Let's go back first. To the early days, 1946, when the world was still staggering under the impact of war. ECOSOC had just held its first session. The emphasis was on emergency matters. What sort of emergency? All sorts. Let's look at the files. Pull out the drawer marked R. R for refugees. The International Refugee Organization was burning much midnight oil in 46.
Between December 1946 and November 1951, they resettled 1 million of us refugees and war displaced persons in new homelands. Since then, the Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees has been handling the problem.
The refugee problem was only one matter. There were many more in 1946. And the way many of them were faced then indicated a long-range forward look at the world's needs. Consult, for example, the file marked B. B for Bank. The International Bank for Reconstruction and Development set up 10 years ago to advance loans for constructive projects all over the world. The bank's headquarters are at 1818 H Street, Washington. Here we're told,
in 10 years, we've advanced 149 loans totaling more than $2.5 billion. That sum breaks down into these figures: $347 million in Africa, 386 million in Asia, 258 million in Australia, 979 million in Europe, 673 million in the Americas.
When you talk in billions, you talk big money. What has it all been used for?
Let me give you just three typical cases, one in Africa, one in Latin America, and one in Asia. Imagine first that you're in Africa, at the Kariba Gorge on the great Zambezi River in the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. The Federal Power Board will explain.
Here in the Kariba Gorge, we're going to build a dam and a power plant with a 500,000 kilowatt capacity. Transmission lines, 1,000 miles of them, will take the power to the copper belt in northern Rhodesia. With expanding production in the mines, it's badly needed there.
For this project, the bank has made its largest single loan, $80 million. Now Asia, India to be precise, and the town of Jamshedpur in Bihar State. The Tata Steel Company will explain.
Under India's second five-year plan, we have to increase our steel production for railways and other construction. We aim to enlarge our annual capacity from our present 800,000 long tons to 1.5 million.
For this, the bank has made its largest Asian loan, $75 million. For number three, Latin America, Colombia, where the problem is traffic and roads. Let a Colombian truck driver tell the story.
In the last 3 years, motor registrations have jumped from 65,000 to 140,000. The traffic volume has doubled over most of the roads. And on the main mountain highways, there is 10 times as much traffic. The way roads are, driving is not much fun, I can tell you.
To complete Colombia's highway rehabilitation program, the bank has advanced $16.5 million for road building equipment and other services. So there you are. Those are the sort of projects we assist. Anything that will help to strengthen a nation's economy.
Our thanks to the World Bank. But as you've probably heard it said, money isn't everything. You need men and brains and skill as well. So open the drawer marked T. T for technical assistance. Technical assistance for the economic development of underdeveloped countries. ECOSOC took the first steps to launch the UN's technical assistance program in 1947. What is the program? We turn to the ECOSOC's Technical Assistance Committee.
Technical assistance is not charity. It's not an organized handout. It's mutual cooperation, the international sharing of skill and technique, and they may be found anywhere. A country needing assistance in one field may provide it in another. The old concept of have and have not finds no place in this program any more than it does in the world as a whole today. The United Nations itself and all the specialized agencies recruit the experts and administer the whole operation. Let me give you an overall picture, or at least an indication of some of the hundreds of technical assistance activities.
Geological surveys for oil and mineral prospecting in Bolivia, Yemen, Nepal.
Forest surveys for timber production in Brazil, Iraq, Jordan. A survey of groundwater resources.
Experts have trained technicians for newly established penicillin factories in Chile, Egypt, India.
Port and shipping experts are helping in the reconstruction of harbors in Jordan and Yemen.
Help in the control of rinderpest and other cattle diseases in Austria, Burma, Ceylon, Ethiopia, Honduras.
Training of school teachers in Haiti, the Philippines, Indonesia, Mexico.
Treatment of the eye disease trachoma in Morocco and Tunisia. A high percentage of cures in 570...
64 million people vaccinated against tuberculosis with the help of WHO and the UN Children's Fund.
Training of civil servants for improved public administration in Jordan, Libya, Lebanon, and Paraguay.
Enough? Does that begin to give the picture?
It does indeed. We can close the drawer, Mark T. With the knowledge that here in technical assistance is something unique in all history and something of incalculable importance in the life of today's world community. The same can be said of ECOSOC's three economic commissions, which we mentioned just now. In Geneva, you'll find the headquarters of the European Commission. In Bangkok, the Commission for Asia and the Far East. In Santiago, the Latin American Commission. The work of the three may vary according to the particular needs of the region, but in all, the objectives are the same.
Yes, we all aim to stimulate economic activity and to ease and strengthen the economic relations between countries. This takes us into the realms of food production, mining, forestry, trade, transport, customs procedures, flood control, financial arrangements, immigration, and electric power. It may sound complex, and it is. We are dealing with all kinds of problems, from the high economics of the balance of payments in trade to the simplification of border formalities for tourists.
We could go on giving evidence like this for a long time, but we must restrict ourselves. We'll pull out just one more file from the drawer marked S. S for social and humanitarian questions. Back in December 1948, the General Assembly of the United Nations proclaimed an historic declaration. It began with these words.
Disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The initial drafting was done by Ikersok. The final text stated that the declaration is a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. But to set a standard is one thing. To achieve it universally is another. And so we find the Ikersok Commission on Human Rights studying how these ideals may be transformed into legally binding covenants. A case in point.
The United Nations Convention on the Political Rights of Women.
And what does the convention guarantee?
The right of women to vote, to hold public office, and to perform other public duties on equal terms with men.
Has it been accepted?
Yes. Last month, Lebanon became the 23rd country to ratify the convention, which came into force just 2 years ago, on July 7, 1954.
We have sought the proof of the Ikersok pudding. I think we found it. But we need a summing up, a synthesis of all the points we've mentioned and the many, many more we haven't. Can our expert put it in a nutshell of reasonable dimensions?
I think so. The process of change and development is one requiring balanced and coordinated plans and actions in many fields. It must be an organic process, for all its many elements are interrelated, not like third cousins three times removed, but as brothers and sisters, if I may use such a simile. The industrialization now taking place in so many parts of the world demands money, capital, trained manpower, and great care. Care in avoiding the terrible social problems that so often in earlier years marked the changeover from the old economy to the new. Recall the sprawling misery of the old factory towns, the slums, the uprooted peasant struggling to adjust himself to cities and machines, the toll in health and happiness. These are experiences which must not be repeated in the new industrial revolution. All the schemes and activities you've heard of are designed to avoid them, as well as to speed the material advance that is all the time gathering force. And behind them all stands Ikersok, like the hub of a giant wheel. We believe that the lesson of our first 10 years is that this great challenge can be met effectively and efficiently by international action.
What does the future hold for Ikersok, for the world? One thing is certain. The course of history since the war will remain unaltered. We've seen millions gain their independence in newly sovereign nations. We shall see more. We've heard the demands for economic equality. We shall hear more. The gap between the industrialized and the unindustrialized is still great and must be bridged. This must be done not as a matter of charity to the poor, but to ensure prosperity even for the rich. In recent months, there has been much hard thinking on the future of economic aid. How should it be organized? What form should it take? Today, we have the international or multilateral approach, as it's called, in the Technical Assistance Program of the United Nations and in the Colombo Plan. And we have the bilateral approach between individual nations, as in the United States Point 4 program. The question now being asked is, what relationship should these two methods have to each other? The statesmen of several nations have expressed their views. Monsieur Christian Pinault of France, for instance, recently suggested that a new UN agency for world economic development should be established. And Mr. Lester Pearson of Canada has said,
what I would like to see is an agreement between all nations contributing to any form of international assistance that they would submit all their plans and policies in this field to the United Nations, where they could be examined, made public, and coordinated.
And the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Nehru, speaking of the multilateral method,
I think that approach is, if I may say so with all respect, a right approach. My submission is that it is far better for this to be organized through the United Nations, better for the giver and better for the taker, and better in the results it produces.
The Secretary General of the UN has put the matter in these words.
My own feeling is that, after all, not only the UN, but internationalism as such is a fairly young phenomenon in its modern form. And for that reason, there is necessarily a question of testing out ways and means, of education, and of demonstration of possibilities. We are certainly still in a state of affairs where a preference in many countries is given to bilateral aid. There are situations where very much can be said for bilateral aid. However, where there is bilateral aid, I would like to see it brought into its proper context in relation to international aid. We have not only not enough internationalization of aid, but I do think that we also lack a little bit the coordination between various bilateral schemes and international schemes.
Whatever the outcome of this debate may be, there is no argument on the basic needs. The promise of the future is too great and the hazards too appalling to permit of anything less than our best, our boldest, our most imaginative, and our wisest thoughts and deeds. The age of the atom, of automation, of a whole new way of life will bring with it its own problems. And ECOSOC can continue at the heart of the international response to them. This is the challenge. This is the course of our expedition. This is the new frontier.
You've been listening to The New Frontier, a program commemorating 10 years of activity by the United Nations Economic and Social Council. Your guest narrator was Edward G. Robinson. The New Frontier, produced and transcribed by United Nations Radio, is another in a series of programs reviewing major developments before the world today.